Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Ancient Wisdom for Modern Life. And today on our beautiful Sunday, we have Swami Mahayogananda with us from the Vedanta Society of Southern California in Hollywood. He's one of my favorite people in the whole world because he is so fun to talk to and he has so much wisdom to share with all of us. So today we thought we'd talk about Sri Ramakrishna and the lessons we can learn from him. But Swami, why don't we start with a chant? Can you start us off with a chant?
Absolutely. We'll start with an ancient chant for modern times. This is the chant that was chanted before study.
Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha viryam karavavahai tejasvinavadhitam astu ma vidvishavahai om shanti shanti shanti.
May we be protected together. May we be nourished together. May we acquire strength together. May our learning shine forth in our lives. May we not find fault with one another. Om, peace, peace, peace.
Beautiful, thank you. So we're going to talk about Sri Ramakrishna today, and I have heard, and this is true for me, that many people first learn about Ramakrishna or come to find out about him through Vivekananda. And that's what happened with me. I was reading Vivekananda's books and I didn't see anything that said Ramakrishna in them. Then when I went to the Vedanta Society in Santa Barbara, I saw Sri Ramakrishna all over the place. And I was like, who's this guy? And that was many years ago. And now I just can't get enough of him. So can you give us a little bit of background on Ramakrishna? Well,
that's right. You know, Swami Vivekananda, he wanted the principles of Vedanta. He taught the principles of Vedanta. He knew that these principles are really a foundation of spiritual life and can be seen as in all religions. And he didn't preach personalities. He rarely spoke about his master in public. In fact, there are only two known talks he gave about his master. And otherwise, he preached principles. And his attitude was, well, if you try to preach a personality, people will say, we already have our Jesus. We already have our Buddha. We already have our Krishna. So what? But if you preach principles, you'll find those principles manifested in all the great teachers of the world. And if you want to know more, you can look at how Ramakrishna manifests those principles in his life too. So it's interesting, Vivekananda did not publicly speak of his master. And oftentimes he would even say, I knew a sage who said, and he means Ramakrishna, but he won't name him. Mm-hmm. And so that was Swamiji. However, I came to Vivekananda through Ramakrishna. I came the other
way. Oh, interesting. How did that happen?
Well, it was really thanks to, you can say, Mother's Grace, the great divine grace. But I was just finishing my college studies and a friend of mine, very excited, wrote me, that was before the days of email, wrote me a letter suggesting that I really needed to read a certain book called Great Swan, Meetings with Ramakrishna. It's a book of meditations on the gospel of Ramakrishna by Lex Hickson. And Sri Ramakrishna came alive for me in those pages of that book. And what particularly drew me, looking back, is the joy. Sri Ramakrishna is always in ecstasy. He is always joyful. He's never unhappy. And sitting in his presence, we also feel happy. And Lex, the author of the book, did such a good job of describing how we, He wrote it in a first person plural, present tense. We are sitting at the feet of the sage of Dakshineshwar, and we feel the joy of his presence. Somehow he wrote it in such a way that we're transported to Dakshineshwar, where Sri Ramakrishna lived for many years, and where he taught, and as if we're sitting in the circle of his disciples, and then we watch him go into spiritual ecstasy, and he loses contact with this waking reality of ours as his mind soars into the infinite divine mother. And tears appear in the corners of his eyes as he experiences the ecstasy of divine communion. And the smile that plays on his lips is beyond description. And then his mind comes down a little and someone starts to sing and he starts to dance and he gets up and he starts dancing. And the bliss of the divine is reflected in every movement of his body as he's dancing. It's not like what we think of as dancing to show off or to make a performance. It was simply an expression of the joy of divine communion. And how the descriptions are wonderful. What to see it would be another experience. M, the recorder of the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, said, "Those who saw that indescribable dancing of the master were never to forget it." So it was an experience just being with Sri Ramakrishna and experiencing his ecstasy, you can say, firsthand. He was experiencing it and we are getting a taste of it just being with him. So that's how I got drawn to Ramakrishna, was a seeker of joy, which we all are. We're all seekers of joy. And he is such a bundle, a source, an infinite fountain of joy, of spiritual joy, which is different, of course, from what we usually think of as joy, but it's a deeper.
Yeah, totally. And it seems like, you know, most of the lessons that we learn from Sri Ramakrishna, we learn from his life, because he didn't write any books himself, right? Vivekananda wrote books and people wrote books about Sri Ramakrishna and his experience and everything, but he didn't write himself. So tell us some of the lessons we learned from how he lived his life.
Well, to me, the first and fundamental message of Sri Ramakrishna is that God can be known, that God is real, the Divine Mother is real, Sri Krishna is real, all the different, however we want, like to think of God, however we like to approach God, is not an imagination. God is real, and we see that in his life, and God can be known. We see that in his life, and that's the purpose of life, is to know God. That's the purpose, the highest purpose of our life, nothing else but to know God. And we see in, say, how he first started his, he came, of course, already not as we come to work out our karma. He came as a teacher. So in his childhood, he was experiencing spiritual ecstasy. But then he embarked on spiritual disciplines. He became a pujari, which means he was worshiping the Divine Mother of the universe in a traditional Hindu temple. And the traditional Hindu temple has an image. The Divine Mother is conceived of, in this particular case, as Kali, who is a female deity, a goddess with four arms and long flowing hair, and oftentimes she's not wearing any clothes at all. And she has a garland of human heads around her neck. She's quite frightening if you don't know what all these things symbolize.
She's fierce. Very fierce. Always. Yeah.
And so he began to worship this mother. But she's an image of stone. And he became taken with the thought, am I just worshiping a stone, or is there really a mother behind it who's manifested here, or who's symbolized here? And this idea took such hold of him that it became a burning obsession, as it were. People thought he was mad. He became day and night only thinking, is mother real? And praying intensely, meditating all night. And then that longing, that fever of longing for God, which is a very important message of his, that longing for God finally culminated in a desire so intense that he could not bear the separation from mother any longer. And as it happened, there was a sword hanging on the wall of the temple inside the sanctum. And seeing it, suddenly he thought, I can't bear it anymore. If I don't see mother, I'm going to end my life. And he reached up to take the sword to cut his own throat. Mm. And that's when the mother revealed herself to him. How did she reveal herself? As an infinite ocean of bliss and light. Right. An infinite ocean of bliss and light, with waves and then coming towards him and then enveloping him. And he drowned, as it were, in that ocean. So we don't know how long he remained in that state, but that was his first realization of Divine Mother. So this again was one of his messages, that the most important ingredient in spiritual life is not what scriptures we know or what special mantras we know or any of that. What's the essential ingredient is longing for God.
Yeah. And
if that's there, everything else will fall into place. If it's not there, spiritual life hasn't really started. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's something we all can identify with. You know, it's hard thinking we have to read X amount of books or get a degree in religion to know God. That's not the way. If we just, with our hearts, we just follow our hearts and long for God. And actually, isn't that how Ramakrishna convinced Vivekananda to come study with him? Because Vivekananda was like, you know, well, have you seen God? Do that kind of thing. And Ramakrishna's like, well, yeah. So I don't know the exact wording, but.
All right. Swami Vivekananda, the young man, Narendranath, he was a seeker, and he was going around to different preachers and teachers and pundits and asking them, have you seen God? And no one could say yes. They were Devendranath Tagore, the father of Rabindranath, the famous poet. He told him, you have the eyes of a yogi. Means you're a meditating type. But no one would say definitely, yes, I've seen God, until he met Sri Ramakrishna. And he went to Ramakrishna and asked him that same question, have you seen God? And without a moment's hesitation, Sri Ramakrishna said, yes, I see God more clearly, more vividly, more directly than I see you sitting in front of me. What's more, I can show God to you. I can teach you to see God. So that's how Vivekananda first came to Ramakrishna.
Yeah. Right. And Vivekananda totally was like, believed him. But at the same time, then he kept testing him.
Yes, he tested his teacher very much. And Sri Ramakrishna didn't mind. He knew that in order for full faith to come, we have to test someone. We have to watch a teacher by day and by night, he would say, before you accept him or her.
Yeah, and I think he liked that Vivekananda was smart, you know, and they questioned him and said, oh, okay, this guy, he's got something there. And how did Ramakrishna know, like recognize Vivekananda was the one to share his message?
He saw immediately. He had a mystic vision. He was not like us ordinary people. He was, he could see someone and know, this is one of my own. This is one who has come. And he had a vision before of a circle of sages immersed in deep meditation in some celestial realm, some heavenly realm. There was a circle of seven sages plunged in deep meditation. And then a divine child took form and went up to one of those sages and clasped its arms around the sage's neck and said, I'm going down. You must come too. And the sage opened his eyes gently and looked with a smile of profound love at that child and assented assented that, all right, I'll also come. And Sri Ramakrishna said, as soon as I saw Narendranath, I recognized him to be that sage.
Aww.
So that's how these are mystical things. And he later also admitted that the divine child was none other than himself.
Yeah.
So this kind of eternal relation between Ramakrishna and Vivekananda.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And even when Sri Ramakrishna was a little kid, he was, you know, like you said, he was having mystical experiences. And I don't know if people knew what to do with him, if the teachers knew what to do with him when he was in school. There's that whole story about how he dressed up as Shiva and then he went into Samadhi or something. And I went to that place in India that happened. And there's a little, you know, statue of him, a child dressed up as Shiva. And I was like, this is so cool. This is where this happens.
Right. It is a beautiful incident.
Yeah. Tell us the story and the significance of that.
Well, he was every year, the worship of Shiva, one of the aspects of God in Hinduism, is conducted in the Hindu villages everywhere in India. And to keep up at night, they it's a night worship, and we stay up the whole night to worship Shiva while fasting. And so the villagers can stay up all night, they arrange various village plays, we can call them village dramas. And people have their parts and their lines and their songs and acting and all of that. And as naturally as part of the village performance on Shivaratri night, someone has to play the part of Shiva himself. And the actor whose part that was fell sick, so he couldn't do it. So they said, well, who's going to do it? Well, our little Godai, who became Ramakrishna, that was his nickname. Let's ask him. And it took him a little convincing, but finally he agreed. And so they dressed him as Shiva. And then dressed him means Shiva has matted locks and he's covered with ashes and he wears a tiger skin. And so they didn't have a real tiger skin, but some kind of lookalike. And then he came out with slow gait on the stage, looking like Shiva. And everybody saw something magical happening here. There's something manifesting here through this boy. And then, but then the play didn't go on. There was no more speaking. He actually became so immersed in the thought of Shiva that he couldn't speak. He just stood there in ecstasy, a few tears rolling down his cheeks, and the play had to be stopped. So what the significance? That his mind from that age was able to immerse itself in the divine. He was filled with the thought of Shiva on Shivaratri. He's dressed as Shiva, and his mind became identified with Shiva. And Shiva is always lost in ecstasy of the divine. So he's like that. He's and you know, there's another little thing about it, which is that in the Hindu villages of that time, there was a lot of, you can say, misunderstanding between the worshippers of Krishna on the one hand, and the worshippers of Divine Mother Kali and the worshippers of Shiva. And there was a little bit of, shall we say, fanaticism. That my God is the only true God. My God is the best God. Krishna is the only path to God. It sounds very much like the fundamentalist Christians who say Jesus is the only way, or the fundamentalist Muslims say Allah is the only way. Even in Hinduism, there are those strands of fanaticism that Krishna is the only way. The only difference is that generally the fundamentalist Christians and Muslims send you to hell forever if you don't follow the right religion. And the fundamentalist Hindus say they just make you come back again and again. So you have to be born as a worshiper of Krishna for you to get liberation, or rather than or whoever it may be, whichever fanatical. So here he is, and he had a similar experience of getting absorbed in the thought of Divine Mother as a child when he was brought to the temple of Divine Mother, Vishalakshi, which is a local village temple dedicated to Mother. And then here he is getting absorbed in Shiva, and later he would get absorbed in Krishna. Many of the village women looked on him as the baby Krishna. So we see how he embodied in his life that other very important message of his, which is the harmony of religions. And he emphasized this again and again in his teachings. And it's manifested in his life from his boyhood. In fact,
yeah, and not only the harmony of the Hindu religions, but he studied Islam and he studied Christianity.
Practiced. We can say practiced. He learned the prayer of Islam, and for 3 days, he didn't go to the temple. He took down all the pictures from his room because Muslims don't use any images in their worship or meditation. And that's right. And he had a profound experience with Jesus and spent 3 days fully immersed in the thought of Jesus. And he had read some of the Bible. And so, yes, in his own life, he demonstrated this ideal, which now is spreading and it's becoming more widely held. It has to spread. It has to keep spreading. Mm-hmm. And that is also our calling. Because Sri Ramakrishna's message isn't only, you know, that God is one, the different religions are but paths. His message is also spread this. We are called to spread this, to embody this in our own lives and to teach the world this most relevant and timely message.
Definitely. And another aspect about him is that he was married.
Yes.
And, you know, when you look back at Jesus and some of these other avatars or sages, they weren't necessarily married, but he was married. I think his family like married him off, right? But tell us the story about how he came to have a wife and how come that wife was Sarada Devi?
Well, he was so immersed in these spiritual practices, he wasn't able to look after himself. And people thought he was going mad. And his mother and elder brother were very concerned about him, feeling he's lost it, no? A wife will bring his mind back down to this plane and he'll be able to lead a normal life. And so they proposed it to him and he didn't seem to object. So they were kind of surprised. But so they started looking around and looking. And it's hard to find someone who's willing to marry a madman because his reputation would have spread by then, right? And, oh, that Golai Chatterjee, he's mad. No, not my daughter. So they were looking and they couldn't find anyone. And then Sri Ramakrishna came to know that they were really concerned. They couldn't find a suitable bride. And he said, why are you looking here and there? Go to the village of Jairampati in the home of the Mukherjees. There you will find the bride marked with straw. And this is also significant. The farmers, when they see a particularly good mango growing on the tree, they tie a straw around the stem so that no one should pick that mango. That mango is reserved for God. When it turns ripe, they'll pick it and offer it to God. Mm-hmm. So she said, there's a girl there marked with straw. And she was actually only 5 years old. This was the tradition those days. It's more of a betrothal. So she was much younger. And of course, another point that is sometimes surprising to people is that their marriage was never consummated on the physical plane. They lived as monk and nun their whole lives, though they lived together for many years and even slept in the same room, slept in the side by side for at least some time. Sri Ramakrishna's marriage was to demonstrate, well, what was it? What do I see in it? Well, on the one hand, demonstration of the divinity of the sanctity of a marriage, of a partnership. And what is it? It's primarily a spiritual partnership. That's the purpose. It's not for enjoyment or for... the purpose of marriage is for us to grow spiritually and to help our spouse also to grow spiritually. We grow spiritually together. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because he was both a husband and a monk at the same time. Only Ramakrishna could pull that off, I think. And so he's the ideal for monks and he's also the ideal for householders. It's wonderful how he could do that.
Yeah, and also like she was the Shakti to his Shiva. So they they helped each other, not just in their personal life, but in spreading the message. She Absolutely. Took care, she took good care of him and fed him and everything. And, you know, he was very particular about his food and stuff because his health was delicate for a while, right?
His health was always delicate, a very sensitive system. I think to made so sensitive by his intense spiritual disciplines and his realizations. And so he couldn't bear the touch of a wicked people, say, or food that had been brought by someone who maybe told lies at the office or cheated on his wife or something like that. He couldn't eat that food. It would have too much of a reaction. He could sense it before even trying to eat it. He would know, and I can't eat that. So she would prepare his meals and look after him in that way. Yes. And of course, she was an integral part of the movement that came up in his name afterwards. And she was the guiding force of that movement. And many people feel she still is the guiding force of that movement.
Absolutely. And then he found these followers. And I've been watching this series called The Chosen. I don't know if you've seen it, but you would really enjoy it. It's on YouTube, it's free, and it's about how Jesus chose his disciples and the story between them. And it's just fascinating. But it's the same thing, like you said, how he saw them and he recognized them. He just knew that was the one, you know? You know, Jesus had these 13 disciples, but Ramakrishna had, what was it, 18 guys, 16 guys?
Well, there are 16, currently 16 young men who are considered, or actually 15 young men and one old man who are considered his primary disciples, the monastic disciples. But he also had other disciples. He had lay disciples, and he had women disciples and men disciples both. And so we had a lot of disciples, but nowadays we think of those 16 who were the monks who formed the Ramakrishna order as some of the principal disciples, because they were part of the monastic order, their names have been propagated more strongly, probably. And some of them, of course, like Swami Vivekananda, he was really the mouthpiece for the message of Ramakrishna. So he's perhaps well known.
Yeah, he did so much because Ramakrishna, since his health was delicate, he couldn't travel very much.
He wasn't one for giving lectures or anything like that. So Swami Vivekananda had that power to transmit spirituality to a hall with hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people in it, and to bear that day after day in lecturing in America, traveling all over the country, back before the days of radio and television. So the only way that ideas would be transmitted in a mass format would be either through paper, like newspapers, or through in person, through lectures. And so thousands of people got the blessing of seeing him and hearing him teach about Vedanta and about their own divinity.
Yeah, wouldn't that have been amazing? So Sri Ramakrishna was, he struggled with his health. And there was a time when he was in great pain, like when he broke his arm. And because he wasn't attached to the body, I guess he didn't feel that pain. So tell us more about that, how he got beyond his physical challenges.
Well, it's a little bit, you know, you said he struggled with his health. And I thought Sri Ramakrishna didn't struggle with anything. By that point, when he was established, he struggled intensely to realize God, to attain spiritual realization. And he underwent intense spiritual disciplines of all different kinds, the different streams of Hinduism and also the Christianity and Islam. And that's where his struggle was. But as far as health, everything else was easy. Everything else was simple. Yes, he broke his arm. He fell and probably dislocated, either dislocated or broke. We're not sure. And his arm was kept in a sling for several months, and it gradually healed. And probably, if you look closely at the pictures of him that were taken later, it looks like it was not set quite right because there's still a funny twist in his arm. Mm-hmm. But It's difficult to say exactly how his experience was, because as long as he's conscious of the body, yes, he would feel pain. And if an insect bites him, yeah, he would feel it, ouch, you know? And yet at the same time, when he was dying of throat cancer and he couldn't talk, it was too painful for him to talk. So yes, it was painful. And yet he was continually immersed in bliss. And one of his disciples said, he said something to the effect that how much he's suffering. And then the disciple said, but sir, I see you're always in bliss. And he smiled and said, yes, you are. You have found it out. So he's, how do we apply that in our own lives? That's a very good question, because we face the difficulties of being embodied and physical challenges, especially as the body gets older. There's pain, there's disease, there's weakness, there's depression, there's all these things. How do we take the message of Ramakrishna? First of all, he had that realization. He had done the work necessary. He had done the intense spiritual struggles. So that's first. We have to do the struggle. We have to gain a taste. We have to get a taste, at least, of the peace of God. That peace, it's there. It's here for the taking. It's ready. We have to seek for it, though. We have to work for it. We have to sit close to the fire if we want to get warm. So that's the first thing. And you know, it reminds me of the privilege of looking after one of our monks in Tribhuco, in the monastery where I joined. An old Englishman was a monk, Swami Bhadrananda. And the last year of his life, I was his attendant. And towards the end, he really did suffer a lot. And he had congestive heart failure. He couldn't even walk. And he was sitting in his easy chair, his recliner. And he said to me something like, it's so mysterious. Amidst all this suffering, this current of joy. And the tears started trickling from his eyes. So I didn't know what to say. I'm a young novice. But amidst all that suffering, also this stream of joy within. So that, can we get a taste of that stream of joy?
Yeah, because then that's like beyond the body, beyond the pain, which is where we really are, right? Who we really are, tapping into it, having that. There was one story I remember where Ramakrishna was supposed to be sleeping or something. And then he heard that the boys were going down to some tree to do something. And someone checked on Ramakrishna, and he was gone, because Ramakrishna got up out of his bed and ran down there to scare a snake away. Tell that story, because I don't
see. Usually, we don't emphasize these stories. These are the kind of miraculous happenings in Sri Ramakrishna's life, and he himself used to emphasize that true religion, true spirituality has nothing to do with these kinds of quote unquote miraculous unfoldings. And Swami Vivekananda said, they're not actually miracles. They have explanations. It's all about the power of the mind. So the power of Jesus to walk on water. Well, yes, the Indian yogis also can develop that power. And the power to stop a storm by a command. Yes, those powers Jesus had, India also recognizes those as powers, so that we can
parting the water.
Right. We can develop those powers. But that's not the aim of religion. The great teachers who come, they have them as a matter of course in the palm of their hand, because they're perfect masters of their minds. They've come as teachers, not as students. So yes, they have these powers. And so, yes, when Sri Ramakrishna was lying in bed, almost unable to move, suddenly Holy Mother, his wife, Sarada Devi, came to the room and found he wasn't there. And she was stunned. And she went out looking for him. She came back, and there he was again. And she said, what happened? Where'd you go? And nowhere. No, I came and I saw the bed was empty. Oh, you see, the boys have gone to tap that palm. There's a date palm and you tap the, like tapping a maple tree, you tap the palm and you get the sap and it makes a very nice drink. So it's something that boys will do, they tap a date palm. In the morning, they have a nice refreshing drink for breakfast. So he said there was a venomous snake, a cobra there, and it would have killed them. So I went there and scared it away. Mm-hmm. So yes, these are powers that are available to the spiritual masters.
Yeah.
But we don't emphasize them. That's not the point of spiritual life, to develop any of these powers. The point of spiritual life is to know who we are, to develop genuine love for God, to develop, to see the divine shining in our own hearts and in the hearts of all others.
Yeah. To me, what that said, though, was that his love for them, those boys, was more than the pain of his body. Like, he could overcome it to protect them because he loved them so much. And he did, you know?
Yes, yes.
He was like a father to them.
Yes, more than a father. They would say that they thought the purest love they experienced was the love from their mother and their father, until they met Ramakrishna and found that his love for them was greater than their own parents' love.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's the love of the divine, no? He's so identified with divinity that the love of the divine just flowed through him. Yeah. And it flows through us too.
Yeah, we can learn so much from his life. And the, you know, the Vedanta Society, we read the gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and then we get to the end and we start it again, because there's so many stories and lessons that you can never hear it enough, and you always get more out of it each time.
Anyway, he has so many delightful parables and analogies and just taken from ordinary day-to-day life that really illuminate a lot of spiritual principles. And say for this this teaching of the harmony of religions, there are some wonderful teachings that he gives us that I also use them all the time to demonstrate or illustrate the principle of harmony of religions. How do you tell someone, well, all religions are true? What do you mean? How can all religions be true? Well, the story of the blind villagers and the elephant is perfect. This wasn't his story, actually. It's an Indian story, but he popularized it. He told it many times. And I think all of us know it, but just in case, in brief, there's an elephant comes to a village and some blind people want to see the elephant. Well, how do you see an elephant if you're blind? Of course, by touching it. So they all touch the elephant and then they feel like, now after all this time, I know what is an elephant. And they start talking amongst themselves and they said, who knew? I know an elephant is like a big snake. That person had touched the trunk. And someone else said, what? I touched the elephant. It's like a broom. That person had touched the tail. And someone else said, what are you guys talking about? I touched the elephant. I know it's like a big pillar. An elephant is like a pillar. Touched the leg. So like that, they're all arguing. They'd all touched the elephant. They all knew what the elephant is like. That's the amazing thing. Yes, they have touched the elephant, but they didn't have the broad enough view to understand the whole elephant. So like that, all the seekers of God in the different traditions, they're all touching the elephant. We're all seeking God. We're all touching God. But just because we realize God as Jesus doesn't mean God can also be realized as Krishna. If we stand back and with the viewpoint of Vedanta, then we see that all the different manifestations are different facets of the one infinite gem, which is the divine.
Yeah. So they're all right.
They're all right in so far as they all take us to the divine.
Right.
If any religion says we're the only true religion, well, they're not right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they're all true in that they all take us to the divine.
Yeah, just like that story about the mountain and approaching it from different places, and you all end up at the same top of the mountain.
Not everybody likes that. Some.
Uh-oh, you're frozen. Uh-oh, he's frozen. Swami M, can you hear me? You're frozen. Hmm. Swami M, if you can hear me, you're frozen, so you might need to sign off and sign back. Oh, there you are. Now you're moving.
I'm back.
Okay, you're back.
Sorry about that.
So we lost you when you said not everyone likes that story about the mountain.
Okay, yeah. Well, the idea that how can the Krishna worshippers and the Allah worshippers be going to the same place? Some people don't like that. But Sri Ramakrishna we followers of Ramakrishna like that ideal. And from the broader viewpoint of Vedanta, we understand that all paths lead to God.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. So at the end of Sri Ramakrishna's life, like I know M, they call him M, who wrote the... Oh,
but may I just interject, because I was going to talk about, I just wanted to mention some of the elephant, the blind people and the elephant. That's one way to explain the harmony of religions, but he has so many. And another beautiful one is the little pond, and the villagers go to get their water from the pond. And some of the villagers are Hindus, and they call the water Jal. And some of the villagers are Muslim, and they call the water Pani. And there's some Christians there too, and they go and collect their water from the pond, and they call it water.
Yeah.
Are they getting different things? Is one getting Jal and one getting Pani and one getting water? No, it's the same stuff. It's just a different name for it. So like that. And moreover, to extend this analogy, we all use our own vessels to get that water. So I bring a pot and I fill a big clay pot. Someone else brings a leather bag and fills a leather bag. Someone else brings a glass bowl and fills the glass bowl with it, or a plastic bucket. And the water takes the form of the container, right? The water is formless, but it takes the form of the container we bring to it. So there is that idea also, that the divine takes form according to the to suit our needs, to fill our container. So if I'm predisposed to love Jesus, I will see God as Jesus. If I'm predisposed to love God as Allah, I will experience God as Allah.
Yep. It's beautiful.
And so, you say that, you can't expect all people to follow the same religion. All people don't have the same power of digestion. A mother gets a fish at the market, and she cooks different dishes for her different kids. And some have strong digestion. She'll cook the heavy dish of fish pilau. Some have moderate digestion, you make a gently fried fish or a little fish curry. And for some who have weak digestion, just boiled fish. Yeah. So like that, we're not all suited for a particular path. Not all are suited to be followers of Krishna, or followers of Jnana Yoga, or followers of Christ. Some are suited to be followers of Shiva or whatever it may be.
Right. And I always think, you know, God is omnipresent and omniscient. So if someone is in Lithuania and another person is in South Africa and another person is in, you know, Guadalajara, everybody speaks different languages. God speaks those languages. We don't have to speak all the languages. We just need to speak one language, and we can talk to God in whatever our language is, because God knows all the languages.
Absolutely.
So at the end of Sri Ramakrishna's life, he knew he was going, right? He knew he was ready. How did he prepare his followers, you know, to carry on?
All right. It's a beautiful question. And it's something to reflect on, those days. He was shifted ultimately to a house on the outskirts of Calcutta, closer than Dakshineshwar, which was called a garden house in Kashipur. And the group of disciples came around him. The young disciples moved in and started nursing him and looking after him. And it was that time that he really tied them all together with his love. There they were serving their teacher, and he inspired them. Really, he bound them together with love, and they began to love him all the more, but also to love each other. And that was important, because his movement is really a movement of love. And the monks, the young men who became monks, they had this intense love for each other. And the other, all of them, all the disciples developed this intense bond of love. And we find that even today, among the devotees, we love those who love God. There's enough love left over. The love spills over and the love flows to everybody else as well. So, right, he did prepare them. And Swami Vivekananda, he would often take Swami Vivekananda into his room and kick everybody else out. And he made Vivekananda the leader of the young men who were to become monks. Mm-hmm. And everybody knew it. He told them, he's your leader. And he told Vivekananda, you guide these boys, you take care of these boys. So it was like that he prepared them. And he said numerous times, he would say, I could easily end this suffering and give up the body. But then I think of how you will be roaming about weeping. And so I hang on. So he stuck on, he stayed in that broken body till it really couldn't last any longer, simply out of compassion for his devotees and disciples who wouldn't have been able to, who he knew would have such a difficulty bearing the separation, and also to keep training them. And then after he left the body, the Holy Mother, his wife, was weeping so much, weeping and weeping. And after several days, suddenly he appeared to her and said, "Why are you weeping so much? I've just gone to the next room." So he's right in the next room.
Yeah. I think the followers also felt his presence, you know, like Absolutely. His body was gone, but he was still with them. Absolutely. Yeah. It's a beautiful, beautiful life. We can learn so much from.
Yes.
Let's open it up to questions. If anybody has any questions for Swami Mahayogananda, just jump in. It's a small group, so just jump in.
Pam looked like you're talking.
Pam's talking, but you're muted.
Sorry.
That's okay.
I don't have a question. This has been one of the most profound spiritual divine lessons I've ever heard, Swami. And I am just so moved. I'm in tears right now. It was so clear and so beautiful and resonated with everything that's within me. So thank you. That's it. All the stories, everything. It truly was. And Lisa's going to be coming on with us. I'm going to use just a little bit and let her run with the rest after this. But honest to God, if I had heard you for the first time, I would follow you anywhere. And so it is.
it's nothing to do with me. It's all around.
The divine within you, not you. The divine within you, I want more of. That's it.
I think a lot of us feel the same way, though, that once we meet Sri Ramakrishna, there's that recognition, right? Like we're all tied. We know the truth when we see it or when we hear it.
Yeah.
And here he is.
I didn't mean you. I meant the divine within you. I should follow you. No.
Yeah.
No, it is that energetic presence that I feel so close to Lisa, with. Yeah. But it was so well stated. Thank you. That's it.
It's always a joy to see you, Pam, and to I look forward to seeing you again in person. All of
yes.
you.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. 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 Yes.
This is a picture of Ramakrishna, and interesting how it was taken. A photographer was brought to Dakshineswar, an Englishman. And of course, in those days, the camera was a big thing on a tripod with you had the glass plate, and the photographer would cover his head with a black cloth and look through and arrange everything. And Sri Ramakrishna wasn't willing to be photographed. So what's to be done? But then Narendra, the future Vivekananda said, well, no, I'll just talk to him about God. Then he'll go into ecstasy. Then we can take the picture. So Narendra started speaking with him. And sure enough, he went into ecstasy. And then bring the camera, set it up, take the picture quick. Don't waste time before his mind comes down. And this picture was taken while he was in ecstasy. And so that's part of the beauty of this picture, that it's not an ordinary picture. He himself said about it, this represents a very high state of yoga. So that's one reason why we especially love this picture and the story associated with it. And on the one hand, it's humorous, just a few words, and Sri Ramakrishna's mind would go towards God so strongly that he would forget this world. And for us, it's so hard to draw our minds to God, even for a moment, and forget this world. So that's the story of this picture.
Yeah. And they have statues made out of him like that, too, that is there in Belermont, the main temple in Calcutta. And he's all over. I have this picture on my... See, I've got him too. I keep him on my computer and on my altar, but I spend so much time on my computer. I want him right by me. Does anybody have any other questions or comments? Well, Swami, I would really love to have another conversation with you about Holy Mother.
Sure. Yeah.
She means so much to me. And, you know, I've read biographies about her and she's led an amazing life that maybe next month.
Okay. We can think about that.
We could do that and talk about Holy Mother because she is such an amazing figure and spirit and still so alive today.
Yes,
so
yes.
Alive today that
yes.
Yeah, yes. It's amazing.
Yes.
Let me share with you also the book, the important book. Let's see where I can find a copy.
Okay. Sounds good.
Well, this is an Indian edition of this book, but this book, if you're not familiar with it, is the records of the conversations of Sri Ramakrishna. It's before there were tape recorders and all those things. There, you have the New York edition there, Parama. Lisa has the New York edition.
Yeah, it's amazing. And there's also, I first read the abridged edition, the smaller edition, because I looked at this book and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's going to take me forever to read this. So I read the small one first and I loved it. So then I could start this and know that, okay, I can get through it.
Right. So who's written it? One of his lay disciples named M. He didn't want to give his full name. He just called himself M and he hid himself as much as he could. But he had already developed this very strong memory, this photographic memory, as it were. And he took notes at the end of every day in his diary of what happened in the day. And so he recorded the conversations and doings of Sri Ramakrishna. But not just spiritual teachings. Whatever he did, if he went to go to the bathroom, he also notes that. He was going to go get shaved. Well, that's also mentioned. So how he lived the daily things of life, as well as the ecstasies and the songs. Sri Ramakrishna often taught with music. And so those songs are also given here with a profound spiritual meaning. So it's a real feast to read in this book. And it's at times extremely humorous, at other times very touching. Sometimes it's really irritating and annoying. And we find some of the people who come to see Sri Ramakrishna are really test our patience, but they never test his patience.
So. Yeah, and there was like a lot of funny things that really show Sri Ramakrishna's personality in there too. Like he was a little bit of a prankster sometimes, you know? He was like a little kid in a grown man's body sometimes. He just played tricks and laughed, and what an amazing person.
Yes. I think that if I would leave us with anything, it would be, again, the joy where we started.
Yes.
That Sri Ramakrishna always enjoy and sharing that joy with us. And that was his name for Divine Mother also, was the all blissful mother, Anandamayi. Ananda is the term for bliss in Sanskrit. Anandamayi, the all blissful mother. What to worry, what to fear? Our mother is all blissful. She is protecting us always. Let's run to her feet. That would be the message of Sri Ramakrishna. Run to her, run to the feet of the Divine Mother and take shelter there. And we have nothing to fear in life. We have only to taste the joy.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Can you chant us out?
Yes. Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotir Gamaya Mrityor Ma Mritangamaya Aviravirma Edhi Rudrayate Dakshinam Mukham Tena Mam Pahi Nityam Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. From the unreal, lead us to the real. From darkness, lead us unto light. From death, lead us to immortality. Light us through and through, and evermore protect us from ignorance by thy sweet, compassionate face. Om peace. Peace, peace. Peace and joy and blessings to everyone.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you
so much. And
awesome. Thank you so much.
Have a great day.
And thank you all for coming. So Swami, mark your calendar for next month when we can talk about Holy Mom.
Okay. I'm going to run to we have our talk at 11. So I'm going to.
Oh, yes. Okay. Bye, everybody. I love you guys.
Love you too.
See you.
See you, Lisa, in a half hour. Okay.